This is the January 26th statutory interpretation class. We're only a few minutes behind, and Jordan was opening up our discussion of the House bill process. And you were basically saying, anybody could, who does it, may affect the, let's say, important credibility of the draft.
Yes.
We could draft a bill at this class right now.
I think so.
Okay, just so you know, I'd actually plan on doing something like that. We were talking with a senator in the Texas legislature who might be willing to carry a bill for us. I'm detecting a certain reluctance because they're getting very busy, but I'll keep trying. If it doesn't work, I have a backup plan, which might make it more interesting. All right, so we've drafted the bill. We've posted it to a website. We've distributed it. What's the next step?
It's got to be introduced.
By?
November.
Okay. Any games you can play with that? Okay. And what would be the strategy?
To ask somebody who would, one, support the bill, and two, have influence on the board.
Okay. Very good. So far, so good. So now we've got our bill. It's actually been introduced into the House. Now what? And at this point, Jordan, you are free to pass the baton to someone else. You can keep running with it. You're doing good so far. He's looking with his peripheral vision. Come on, guys. Help them out. All right.
It's got to be referred to the committee.
Okay. And how is that determined?
I'm actually not totally sure.
Hand goes, and your name?
Brian.
Bryant or Brian?
Brian.
Brian, thank you.
Yeah. And it's determined by the type of bill that it is. They try to consent to the appropriate committee. Sometimes, though, they can be in there or say sometimes.
I'm sorry, Brian, I'm having trouble hearing, so I'm sure they can't hear back there, too.
Right. I think in the reading they were saying sometimes they'll try to spread it out to different committees. I don't know if I read that correctly.
But is there any sort of game plan as to which committee gets which draft?
Yeah, which one they think is probably going to favor or has the most interest.
Okay.
So there's more games, I guess.
Oh, I'm all right. Call me out if I get too much wrapped up in a certain perspective. I sometimes find myself thinking of law as a tool. I don't mean to say game is in a dismissive way, but advocacy does involve some sense of strategy.
Right, yeah, so, strategy is probably the better word for it.
Okay.
Strategically, so it doesn't get killed right away, I guess, or.
So certain committees have certain jurisdiction, standing committees, basically. And that allocation process is done by the speaker, because the speaker controls all, he or she. But at the same time, that process is guided by House rules, which determine which standing committees have jurisdiction over which areas. All right, so good so far. All right, Jordan, you can buy Brian a coffee some point later, because that was a great supplement to your end. Let me stop and pause here before we start working our way through the rest of the chain. I wanted to stress to you that this may feel a little bit like high school civics class. Not so. Each one of these steps, I can tell you, lawyers are deeply and intimately involved in. I've been involved in drafting bills. I've actually been worked with members as to how to get them introduced. There are very strong and lucrative practices in Washington, D.C., with strong relationships here in Houston, where you'll be asked as associates, if you work at a firm or NGOs, to be doing exactly this kind of stuff. So it's time to, you know, actually dredge this and start thinking about how you can use these with these tools to put in your hand. All right, so it's referred to a committee. Presumably, if the speaker wants it to live or die, it's referred to a committee that makes sense for it to be considered.
Right, that's more
what I mean. Well, no, that was exactly right. Next, what comes is now landed in the committee. What happens to the bill at that point?
The committee takes action.
Okay. So, you know I'm going to say, what action?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, and...
Julia.
Thank you, Julia. Your row is going to mix me up because you wrote your name's reversed on the seating chart, so it's just... So I know George's not Julia, but it may take a little while. Okay.
It can be referred to subcommittees, hearings held on major bills, and committee resolutions take no action, etc.
And I'm sorry, could you say that then a little bit more simply, because...
So they can basically take the bill, and they can take no actions on the bill whatsoever, they can amend it, or they can accept it or
Well, before they start actually gnawing on the carcass of the bill, though, one thing that may happen is it actually gets handed down even further. And I think you'd mentioned it when you gave your first dance. I just want to tease that portion out.
Oh, when it gets referred to the subcommittee?
Right. Any process rules or governing how subcommittees pick up a bill?
I'm sorry, can you say
that? Any rules that govern how which subcommittee gets a bill? And that's not a trick question, but it is a question about something that's not in your book, because there is no rule. We'll look at the example of that in the Civil Rights Act. So you're okay. Okay. All right. And just so you'll know, 90% of the actions at the subcommittee level. Any bill that has a prospect of survival, the people are really going to focus on will be a very relatively small subcommittee that has substantive expertise of the subject matter area involved. So now, basically, we've thrown the bill into the pit, it's rolled its way down, and now it's finally landed where something's actually going to happen to it. And now, what happens at that point? You were starting to outline some of the things, good or bad, that could happen to the bill.
So what things good or bad could happen?
Mm-hmm. What's the next step in the process? Okay. That assumes, of course, someone wants this bill to survive.
Right.
Okay. We're sort of hitting our first divide in the road here. If this bill was handed to a committee where the committee chair didn't want it to survive, what would she do?
Kill it.
How? Write a letter saying this bill shall die. What tactic gets there?
Okay.
I'm sorry, your name?
James.
And you're way back there, James, so just speak up.
They can send it to a hostile subcommittee.
Okay. And?
If they're not for the bill, they would try to, I guess.
Now you're absolutely right, but with some other things besides referring to the land, you know it's going to die a grisly death.
I'm not sure.
Okay. You're thinking maliciously, so. And I'm sorry.
Don.
Donna. Okay. This is my middle name's Donna. I was about to keep going.
May I put it on the calendar to discuss it within the subcommittee?
I'm sorry, I missed the first one. They will or will not.
Put it on the calendar.
Basically, limbo.
Yes.
It never sees a light of day. And that's probably where the fate of most bills ends up. Certainly, I'll say everything we're talking about at the federal level applies roughly to the state level, but certainly in the state Texas legislature, most bills go to committee, and they're gone. Never get a hearing, never get consideration, 90% of them gone. All right, so send it to a hostile subcommittee, never scheduling action on it. I thought I saw a third hand go up. Yes?
But she took my answer.
Oh, then it must be a really good answer. All right. Okay, so now it's in a subcommittee, they're having hearings. Hearings go on for a while. What's the point of hearings? Wow. Oh, that wasn't coffee. Okay. All right, I asked, what's the point of hearings? I'm sorry, what was your name?
Amanda,
thank you. I was about to say, being named after an aminic acid would be kind of unfortunate, but. Amanda. What's the point of that? Why bother hearing people out? You can do that outside of hearing.
Basically, you want to have support for the bill, basically, public opinion on your side, or at least you don't want to go to court yourself. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in a sense, you're getting not only an opportunity to hear people, but you're also getting them to put some commitment to it, some public demonstration. for or against? I'm sorry, your hand was up.
It also builds legislative history.
All right. In what way?
In that you can make a record of the debate that took place at the time it was passed.
So you basically will have hearings testimony as an output. Out of curiosity, I know many of you probably lived the life of debate or been involved in poli-sci. How many of you have actually gone through and reviewed hearings transcripts? No one? Really? Oh, a few hands. Okay, thank you. It's a tedious but still necessary art. Keep in mind, you're absolutely correct, both of you, in terms of the hearings process does create a public statement of for or against a bill, but also creates a tangible output that could be important for us as lawyers down the road, namely transcripts of not only this testimony, but also questions and interaction of the parties involved, including the congressman. But we've had this educational step, we've had several days of hearings. The point comes, you're finished. What's the next step once you've concluded the hearings? All right, I should warn you, scratching your nose is very dangerous.
That was an accident, though. Okay. Well, I guess then the committee decides what they want to do. They can amend it, and they can take action on it. Do they accept it? Do they want to report it? What do they want to do with it?
That's true, but the crucible for that decision is a specific type of process. Namely, they've got the bill sitting in front of them, and it's naked and newborn glory. They've had hearings about how that text is good or bad. Next step, then, for the subcommittee is to have the members get together and amend it by marking it up. You have a markup session. If I could highlight points in this process for you as future lawyers to pay special attention to, I mentioned the drafting portion. You'll be surprised how many bills are written not by legislators, but by lawyers, often lawyers for hire, often lawyers who are seeking to achieve a specific purpose. We tend to have sort of minor role at these stages, but hearings, lawyers craft that testimony frequently. And more importantly, markup. Now, I'll be honest with you, probably most of you in this room, if you're going to be doing corporate transactional law, if you're doing antitrust law, if you're going to be doing torts, you may not be as involved in markup. But I'll tell you, this is where the lawyer's hands are often in the guts of the machinery. They will actually be there to offer input and suggested drafts on how to markup the bill, because the markup session is one of the most substantive but least transparent steps in the process. Very few people know what's actually going on. There's no real transparent record as to where suggested changes often come from. So we have the markup. Then, I think the next step was, heard the word amendment, is that correct? So at that point we've had a markup, but at this point, amendment implies that you're actually amending an existing legislative vehicle. So the markup essentially means that you might move to amend the bill as it's required on the subcommittee by substituting new language for it. So to a certain extent, it's like amendment, although the amendment's going to pop up in different varieties and shapes later in the process. I'm sorry, is this too low for y'all to read? Ah! The screen's nice, but we're not using it. Better? The podium's still a problem. Now, of course, so we've gotten down to the amendment process. The committee, subcommittee is done. What's next? They've got the text the way they want it, the way they did.
They vote.
And I'm sorry, you.
Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, they vote to send it to the full legislative chamber.
Well, in a way, remember, we're talking about the subcommittee. So let's just, if y'all will indulge me, I'll put one last step down here before we move up to the next column. Referral from subcommittee to full committee. But then Sarah's exactly right. The full committee at that point has the option of conducting its own hearings and perhaps replicating some of these steps, but typically will not. They'll refer it to the House if they want to proceed further for consideration. All this hopefully is stuff you already know. Here's where things start to get weird. What happens then when it gets back to the full House after it's gone through the legislative grist of the committee process? Sparing you from the random selection process.
Don't yes. They
have another committee from the full House? I'm sorry, you both had your hands up. I missed your hand. It's like, go ahead. Since you jumped in.
Don't the full House have another committee?
Explain. How can the full House be a committee?
Well, because they send a bill to the House and then like debate on the bill.
Mm-hmm. So, does the debate sort of take place pell mell, rumble tumble? Sorry, we've got puppies in my house. I'm reading the Poke Little Puppy a lot these days. Yes?
It gets scheduled on one of several calendars, whichever one it's supposed to be on.
All right. It gets in line. It's added to the House calendar. Indulge me, there are multiple calendars. We will talk about that in our next class. As it is, I want to make sure we're out on time because Professor Kumar deserves that respect. So, add it to the calendar. And is that it? What's the next step?
It may be called up to be considered. I mean, there's like several rules which I guess you can sometimes get around that, like the suspension of rules.
Oh, you're so close. You've got the spirit, but there's a concrete step that takes place that puts some bones to this process. Yes, your name?
Marcella.
Thank you.
It's referred to the Rules Committee.
Okay, explain.
So major bills are usually brought to this committee where they kind of structure the debate and how it's going to happen. They give the time for the debate and who, I guess, like what topics need to be brought up and if amendments are able to be added to the bill during the floor discussion. It basically how the bill is going to be introduced and discussed like, with the whole House.
Excellent. And essentially, you set rules about how you're going to talk about the bill. And as you might expect, those procedural type of rules can almost be outcome determinative. And we'll talk about open and closed and modified versions of both of those categories in our next class. But Marcella is exactly correct, and I will promise not to make Games of Thrones references during class, but it's really hard to resist. Okay. Goes to the Rules Committee, and the Rules Committee sets the standard and terms for the actual debate. And think about it. If you have the ability to try and protect a bill you want to pass, being able to say that only certain types of amendments can be offered is huge. Being able to say only 5 minutes will be guaranteed to each party is huge. So the Rules Committee is a major stop in this process. But then they create the rule. Next step, the rule's been determined, defining how the debate will proceed. Next step, obviously, is the debate proceeds, right? Where does the debate take place? And then now, here's what my memory is beginning to fail me. Someone said the House as a committee. Who was that? I want to give credit where it was due. I'm offering you free credit. Someone's passing it up. All right. What's the next step once the House rule's been established and we've got a debate that needs to take place? Where's the debate happen? Is it just the floor of the House?
Is it just on the floor of the House? The House of Representatives themselves?
So close. And I'm not asking yes, I'm guessing. But you're absolutely correct in one sense. It is the full House. But it's a certain strange variant on it. in that the Speaker of the House actually hands the gavel to someone else for the debate to take place. Thank you, Jordan. What does that mean? You knew I was going to ask that. So.
Yeah, I thought I'd let you do the other reason. I guess it's just, is it just who shows up to argue the bill?
Let's, all right. I will always say, that's a great thought. A lot of times, though, I have to say, it's more than just showing up. That'd be sort of like, say, our class debate would be basically it's only who shows up for class, in which case, by mid-semester, I'm going to be sort of having to round people up in the hallways and then talk with us. Key thing here. The committee of the whole, which, I'm sorry, I didn't ask your name.
Hallie.
Hallie. All right. You realize the first thing I think is Halle Berry, but yeah. Okay. Hallie's point is that there's a committee. Who's on that committee? Hint is, it's in the name of the committee. Hallie?
What's
the name of the committee we're talking about?
Is it the whole?
Committee of the whole.
Yeah.
Right. Essentially, the House dissolves. The House reconstitutes itself as a special committee that consists of the membership of the House. That gavel gets passed to the chair of this new special purpose committee, which is going to proceed solely by the rules committee that has handed out this special rule for debate. Essentially, it's a stripped down, modified version of the House of Representatives, where you have very truncated rules on how the debate will take place. Its sole purpose is to create a little tightly redefined universe. So this one bill is a thing that gets considered and gets passed or rejected. So, committee of the whole. So finally, we get to the defining essence of what the House of Representatives is supposed to be all about, the debate of the bill itself. Okay? And at that point, it takes place pursuant to the Rules Committee, special rules created for the legislation. And we can have, at this point, coming back to some of our key terms, amendments offered up during the consideration. Now here's where I said things get a little wonky. If someone moves to amend a bill, for the committee of the whole, is there a record of that? I'll pause here because it's tucked away in your book. It's one of those elliptical, small, throwaway references that just hides how important it really is. No. I'm sorry, your hand was going up. Or you were stretching.
No, it was weird.
It was a reflex.
It's unrecorded votes unless one of the numbers asked for.
Right. Very good. And, sorry, what was your name?
Ian.
Sorry?
Ian.
Okay. Ian is exactly correct, which means the debate that we're used to thinking of in the House as the defining evidence of parliamentary procedure, the people who make the biggest changes to the bills may never be known. Remember, one of the things we talked about with the hearings process here was to create an output of testimony that's going to be useful in determining what the legislation might mean later. The committee of the whole may gut a bill, rewrite it from scratch, and you may never know which hand was on the blade when it happened. Unless, as Ian rightly pointed out, one-fifth of the members say, light of day on this one, guys. All right? You all clear so far? Continuing to flag things. Lawyers are often involved in the Rules Committee discussions behind the scenes. Lawyers are often very much involved in the debate, in the sense of crafting statements and testimony that might be offered later by some of the legislators. All right, so we've had the amendments offered. We may even have full substitutions of the bill presented. And then at the end of the day, the committee's done. And there's a vote on whether or not proceed to refer it out of committee back to the House. There, it's pretty straightforward what happens at that point. The committee dissolves and the full House takes it back up. And then finally, at the end of this gruesome process, we finally get an up or down vote on the bill. but out. All right, so I'm pausing here. I've missed one thing that's important that I want to make sure we don't overlook. Remember I'm talking about outputs, things that you want to grab hold of and use as tools, as lawyers, as part of this process. We talked about hearings testimony. One key thing is when it's referred out of committee and referred from the full committee back to the House, there's always a mandatory document accompanying that bill, the committee report. The committee report is going to be fairly structured. It's going to have the text of the bill. It's going to have a section-by-section analysis. That's some required assessment of potential issues of such things, such as financial impact. But it is a seminal document. If you want to understand a bill from the Congress, the reports are usually one of the most important directives if you're going to go beyond the simple text of the bill. So, testimony and report. And then, once it goes to the House and there's a debate on the bill as it's been referred out to the Committee of the Whole, this testimony here, especially by sponsors, is very important. All right, so now we all take a deep breath. We've got through the House process so far. We haven't gotten to the Senate yet. So any questions before we talk about the Senate briefly? Yes?
Could you just repeat the last instruction you gave with the testimony on the House with the report? I kind of lost. Like literally the last 30 seconds.
The last 30 seconds?
Okay.
I think what I was saying was, think about it in terms of outputs that you can use as a lawyer from this whole grisly process. Simply say, you can look to hearings testimony, you can look to the actual reports of the committees, and then you can also look to statements, I misspoke there, by legislators during the full House debate, which does take place on the record, which does offer relevant information on what the Congress meant when it passed the bill. And I would say in particular statements by sponsors or authors of the bill as special lawyers.
Thank you.
Sure. Does that get what you were asking for? Okay. All right. Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
So the part
I'm sorry, your
name? Liz.
Liz,
yeah.
Okay.
So the part with the section analysis and the financial impact, is that the report stage at that four referral step there? Or is that what you're referring to?
I've seen it here in the report.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, great question. Any other questions? All right. Then, very briefly, perhaps not with quite as much detail, how does the Senate process work? Because remember, we're trying to get a map of this so we can talk to the Civil Rights Act and how it varies from it. How does a bill typically go through the Senate, and why don't we just talk about with the House? I'll say this, Scott. Draft the bill. You've got to have something to kick it off. And essentially, just like the House, a bill can come from anywhere. A bill, bless you. I missed a sneeze. It was a very quiet little sneeze back there. So, draft the bill. Next up, the bill is introduced. Does it matter which place you start? Excellent answer. It's the most lawyerly answer you'll ever hear. And sorry, your name?
Colton.
Colton?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. A servant. Ugh, I feel my hair growing gray when you say that. Yes. Why is it the fifth?
Because the Constitution gives the House authority over budget bills.
Mm-hmm. So, for power of the purse, appropriations, taxes, you're going to the House. Senate, obviously, there are certain areas it has prerogatives as well. Things like ratification. But outside of these special constitutionally allocated requirements, is there any other dictate as to why it go to one versus the other, or is it simply can you start either place? Let me offer an example. Think about the civil rights legislation we just read about. This is the place we start incorporating for our discussion. Which one started first on the Civil Rights Act? You're nodding your head, yes. I hope that means because you know the answer, because you think it's a kind of a grieving thing to say. Did the House or the Senate start first or the Senate? Okay, sorry.
The House did.
The House did, okay. Any reason why?
Maybe they felt a stronger answer that way.
Okay. Tactical, strategic, not legal, not constitutional, not by House or Senate rules. They simply thought the Senate was a cesspit of hostility and that they have a better chance of building momentum starting the House. Bottom line is, you can start either path and then go back to the other one, absent the ones that were mentioned previously as constitutionally allocated provisions. Okay? Now, next step on the Senate. I'm sorry, Ms. Saw, I can't hear you.
Sorry. It's referred to one of the committees.
Well, first thing that has to happen is before it even gets to the committee, there's what you might even call an archaic initial step. Remember, a bill has to be what, three times?
Oh, read.
Read. At least at the time that we're talking about with the Civil Rights Act. First reading. Second reading. And then you have Marcellus Hassett, correct, a committee referral. Here, I'll do a small revision and simply say, it's gonna look fairly familiar. It's gonna be allocated to the Senate committee that has organic jurisdiction over the topic. That committee chair has very vast powers over how the fate of the bill shall be determined, and it can be sent down to a subcommittee with special expertise. You can have hearings in much the same way with reports, testimony, and markups. So to a certain extent, I'll just bracket say hearings. Okay, all clear so far? Yes?
The book mentioned that you could make objections after the first and second reading. Is there any reason why they'd want to do that? Just so everybody knows their objection or something.
Well, they can object, first of all, simply because they want to stop the bill. Now, the thing about the Senate that is organically and fundamentally different is that there is much less structure imposed in the ability of any individual senator to control the process. So essentially, we're going to talk about tonight, that's a great segue, the ability to hijack the process through having filibusters. But you can object to the secretary of the bill, the referral to the committee, and reject to the reporting out of the committee, and object to consideration of it out of order ahead of anything else in the calendar ahead of it. Okay. All right. Any other thoughts or questions so far? All right, let's finish it up then. Again, notice we're starting to see parallels. Calendar. And essentially, it's just put in order. When it shows up, first in line, first in place. The only way you can get a bill that's more important out of line behind very small minor bills in the House, the Rules Committee saves the day. This bill is important, it goes ahead of everyone else. The Senate, here's one major difference, has no Rules Committee. There's only one way to bump up ahead in line. That is essentially unanimous consent. One senator can kill a bill, in theory, by refusing to give it a special place in line. And the only way to override that is to actually have a debate on the bill itself. Debate on a motion to change it that the full Senate has to vote on. Okay, so you're starting to get a sense the Senate's a different place. you can understand why individual senators have much more power and the ability to take a more prominent role in the legislative process. So, place in the Senate calendar. The debate is also different. There is no committee in the whole in the Senate. There is no rule saying how long each senator can talk. It's unlimited debate. There is no rule saying which amendments are germane or non-germane. The senator can add anything he or he wants to a bill. All you get it? Okay. Once you've had that debate, you get the third reading, and then the vote. Now, for those of you who really, really like this stuff, you can actually go through and pull up the House rules and the Senate rules, which provide much more gruesome details, specific rules on each step of this process. And we'll talk about a few of them that are particularly germane to the Civil Rights Act. But for now, this is a sort of high-level schematic. Any questions about these general rules before we start talking about how the Civil Rights Act broke them?
Yes.
So for this course, we should focus on the rules as they were at the passage of the Civil Rights Act, not contemporary rules or anything like that.
Okay. In fairness, whenever someone says for this class, I'm going to start probably getting a little bit vague on you. But I'll be fair with you. For in terms of what I expect you to know by the end of this class, I'm not going to be asking you what were the rules of 1963 under Senate Rule 21 for referral bills. What's the point? What I'm going to be asking you is, what's the general process, especially as it might exist now, we'll talk about our next class. And I almost always, spoiler alert, tend to ask questions in a functional way. You are representing X. X wants to achieve Y. Here is a bill at this point in the House. What options are open to you as a lawyer advising your client? I find that lens gives much more clarity as to what's important, what isn't. Does that get to what you're asking?
Sure.
So this is important what we're talking about, since a lot of this is still the rule. But we'll find it's been tweaked in some different ways, but this framework is still in place. And the 1963 Civil Rights Act is a great example of what's ultimately now become more of the norm. Namely, how do you hijack this process to get something done in a partisan environment that might otherwise frustrate national interests? Okay. So with that in mind, any other questions? That was a great question. Any others? I don't think I've ever been teaching and said that was a stupid question. So, and hopefully no other professor's ever told you something like that. So far, so good for all of us. Okay. All right, so with that in mind, what happened in 1963? How did the Civil Rights Act work its way through this grinder? We already know the ending. The Civil Rights Act was passed. We also know, shockingly, the Civil Rights Act was passed in strong form. Think about that at the time. It's rather astonishing. So, in the House, what was done with the bill to sort of promote its passage? Where was it referred to? It's the first step. Yes?
The Antitrust Committee.
Right. Why would the Antitrust Committee, actually, let me phrase that more specifically. Which committee, the Antitrust Subcommittee got it ultimately, you're quite correct. But which committee got it first, above them?
I didn't get that part.
Anyone else want to jump? Yes, your hand's up in that.
House
Committee,
Sheriff.
Is it Anjulish?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me try to pronounce it correctly. Which committee?
House Judiciary Committee.
Right. Why would the House Judiciary Committee get the Civil Rights Act?
They have jurisdiction over, like, civil rights bills.
Mm-hmm. and other legal type bills. Notice already, and you may hear about this if we're lucky, from someone who's actually doing this on a daily basis fairly soon. The first element of advocacy has already happened before we even knew it. The title of the bill. It was called the Civil Rights Act for a very specific reason. Anjali has just pointed out exactly what it was. It affected which committee got it. If it had been called something else, it might refer to the House Committee, for example, on Health and Human Services. Completely different strategy, completely different fate. You can dictate which committee gets the bill by choosing how you describe it and what title you give it. So then, you're quite right, then got referred to subcommittee number 5. And what happened at that point?
Well, he sent it there because he knew that there was a lot of advocates in that subcommittee. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of pushed it along the way more fluidly.
Absolutely. And interesting enough, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee was actually the chair of subcommittee number 5. So he referred it to himself. Manny Selman is actually a legendary New York politician, very interesting guy. So we now have got it basically hand-steered, this bill, to the most favorable place as a chance of survival. It was the one subcommittee that actually had a minority-ranking Republican who was sympathetic to this bill, even though he was from a small rural country, small rural county in Ohio. At that point, not a whole lot happened to the Civil Rights Act. It looks a little bit different. It had hearings. It had marketing. It was reported out. Now, there was one place where it went off the rails. Namely, and here again, we're starting to talk about strategy. There were a couple of different ways you could try and get this bill through if you really wanted the Civil Rights Act. Well, what did Manny Seller do to the bill with the idea of trying to get the best act you could at the end of the process?
And he needed a much stronger bill.
Kristen?
Yes.
Thank you, Kristen. Okay. So why is that good or bad? What's the matter with that?
I think you noted that in the past, they put bills through and it kind of watered down in line of compromises. But his strategy was just to come in with a stronger bill so that he could still look good about compromising, but that he could end up with really something more of a wide and functional plan.
Okay, so why was it strong in the first place? Right. Well, let me ask, who wrote the first bill?
Was it the president or someone who
thinks they can? Excellent. President Kennedy. So he wrote a bill, sorry, not the person, but the White House wrote a bill that kicked the process off, that was crafted to push as far as it could, but not too far. Manny basically took it and said, to Shaw, I'm going to make this the best possible bill I can because it's going to get hacked at some point. If we start off essentially as far as we can on one side, we may end up in the middle place where I really want to be. Essentially, a haggling model of Congress. Now, why was that a problem? Did it have a downside in terms of, did Manny take a risk by doing that? Let me say it perhaps more bluntly. Who did he piss off? With the ranking minority leader, that they would coordinate and consult. Manny basically took the ball and ran with it. Talk about betrayal. So at that point, the subcommittee basically, the Republicans said, you take this bill, it stinks. We're not going to have anything to do with it. Matter of fact, the worst thing we can do to this bill is not change it. We're going to send it out because we know it is doomed to die. And therefore, it was referred to the Judiciary Committee as it stood under Manny's provisions. Hanging together so far? Bless you.
Wow.
Man, you actually sound pretty snorkely over there. Okay. I know everyone around you is starting to lean in the road. Okay, so I want to make sure we don't lose too much time to go through too much fine grain of detail. You're getting a sense that there are certain strategic and advocacy calls made and the way to try and get this book in the process. The Civil Rights Act so far has kind of gone down the line. We've had some strategy in terms of which committee got it. We've had some strategy in terms of the markup of the bill. Now it's been referred out, and the House Judiciary got it. Now at this point, what's the next step in the process? It's right there in the board behind us. The Judiciary Committee refers it to louder, prouder.
Full.
Sorry?
Full committee.
Full committee. Before it gets to the full committee, what do you have to have?
Rules.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Why is that a problem? Yeah, I'm glad that private reporter did not pick up on that one.
Because this is a major bill, and usually major bills require rules of coordinating, making it more happy, essentially.
Well, that's a wonderfully generic and vague answer, and I'm very impressed by it. Thank you. But Congress is personalities. I'm sorry, I picked on you that word. Ben, thank you.
The rules committee chair of the House.
Does that sort of give the full richness and flavor of it? Who
was
the chair?
I can't remember his
name. Anytime you have a representative whose first name is referred to as Judge, and he's from the South, you're in trouble with the Civil Rights Bill. All right. So Judge Smith chaired the Rules Committee. What was Judge Smith's perspective on civil rights legislation? Yeah, at the best. This bill was dead under this process. Because he could basically sit on it. It would never get out of the Rules Committee. You never get a rule that allows debate to proceed. And this is what happened with civil rights legislation previously. All right. So how do you break the rules? How do you hijack the process at this point?
So the first one is the discharge petition, where you can basically remove a bill from committee after it's been in the committee for 30 days to do a petition signed by the majority of the House.
Alright, what are the odds of that passing?
Slim to none.
Right, this is the classic Hail Mary. You'll see people circulating discharge petitions. Chances of them getting approved are virtually nil, but it is a tool, you're quite right.
And the next one was Calendar Wednesday, which allowed the speaker to call standing committees in alphabetical order to ask if the chairman wishes the House to consider any bill previously reported out of the committee. But the Democratic leadership just adjourned the House before Wednesday, so they couldn't do that.
Why?
Because they didn't want the bill to be brought.
They wanted the bill to be brought.
They could defeat it by calling up other bills because they were alphabetically not high. There were like 11 committees before them.
I, at the risk of offending no one, Southerners were crafty folk back then. I'm not sure, maybe they not realize it, but I actually grew up in a time when the Texas legislature was all Democratic, and all of our representative senators were all Democratic, and they all looked exactly like Republicans look now. They were very adept at stalling and strangling civil rights legislation. Calendar Wednesday, the Judiciary Committee is obviously way back in the line. Southerners were just, for example, at the Agriculture Committee, killed by delay, because it only could be done on Wednesday. By the time that they got to the bottom of the ranks, they'd run out of time. All right, what's our third option?
It is House Rule 11, which allowed any three members of the committee to request the chairman to call a meeting to consider a bill. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't scheduled within 3 days, the majority of the committee could schedule one.
Right, so essentially a mini discharge petition. And also a little bit of a gamble, but this is typically the way you're going to try and break the stranglehold that the Rules Committee has over a bill that's getting through. And Marcel is exactly right. This is the tool that was used. This is the one that got it out. So again, the thing about it is not that you need to know House Rule 11 and the internecine operations of House operations. This is the fact that we've broken the mold. But this is essentially taking a major piece of legislation and routing it through, but it's really at that point a very obscure bypath to try and keep it alive. It worked. Judge Smith ultimately had to refer it out of the Rules Committee based on the fact that he was being threatened with a vote. He decided not to dilute his power by doing so, and it got kicked out. The rule was crafted and voted on and passed, and we got to committee the whole. Last thing where things got weird. During the committee of the whole markup and debate, remember I said this is where the things can be rewritten behind closed doors. Did the act suffer any major damage or major expansions during the debate of the committee of the whole?
Judge Smith tried adding steps to the bill.
Well, you have to explain that.
Right. Well, he tried to get it to also cover women in terms of employment discrimination, I think. And I think essentially when you expand something that much, it has a tendency to, I guess, anger a lot of folks who would then try to kill the bill there and then. So it kind of seemed like he was trying to do something good, but actually he was trying to do some bad instead.
You know, maybe at some point, you know, we'd have a cup of coffee or lunch and I could debate with you about that. Yes, there is an interpretation Judge Smith was trying to kill the bill by making it stronger. Remember how we talked about the subcommittee number 5? This pail of garbage will never pass. Judge Smith theoretically made it tougher to approve the Civil Rights Act by adding this provision that expanded to a wholly new area at the last minute on the floor of his house. Basically making sex also a condition that would be protected by the Civil Rights Act. What I might argue with you is I actually think he was sincere. If you actually look at the legislative record and some of his communications with his constituents, he actually had been a proponent of equal pay for women, which is weird given his other beliefs, but nonetheless, you can respect that. But bottom line is you're quite correct. The act went a major expansion during the Committee of the Whole deliberation. Again, that's not necessarily breaking the rule, but it's unusual. Oftentimes, the committee of the whole deliberations are meant really to get the bill done. All right, so done. The House has finally got it done. We've got hearings, we've got records, we've got the rule passed, we've got the entire bill passed, we've got the amendments adding sex to it. The other side of the board's blank. We haven't gotten to the Senate yet. So, first question. Obviously, they took the House bill as passed, and that was their starting point. So I don't have to worry as much about this step. It was introduced, and then first reading, formality. It almost sounds quaint. You can almost picture a scrivener standing in a frock coat in front of the Senate. After the first reading, second reading takes place. Which committee got the Civil Rights Act in the Senate at that point? Excellent. That was the closest I'll get to a trick question today, I promise, but you caught it. What happened?
Senator Mike Mansfield made a motion to have the bill placed directly on the
floor. Why? Doesn't that seem like a long, hard way to do it?
No.
You go to a committee, you build the record, you're kind of hijacking the process.
Yeah, but if you put it into another committee, there's more chance of the bill getting cut down. I think they were pressured. They were more, as time went on, they were more and more pressured to get the bill signed.
So is it time saving stuff?
No, I think it was more.
I'm teasing a little bit. It's sort of what happened to the bill after that. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The debate. Yeah. But I think it was to avoid any other hiccups.
Right. Sorry to breathe. You just something thoughtful. Oh. Okay.
Yeah, but a tax bill he was interested in also didn't want that delay.
Absolutely. And we haven't even talked about that. This is all focused tunnel vision on the Civil Rights Act. it ignores the fact that there's a host of other bills bumping and fighting for attention. And there are several critical delays created by the need to get other legislation passed to even gotten the Civil Rights Act. Tax bill being one of them, that was for the House. So, moving right along though, instead we have a referral directly to the entire Senate. They bypass this entire step here. No hearings, no record, no testimony, no markup. And sentence, they get a newborn glory straight to the floor of the Senate and to the county. At least that was the intent. I'll simply say it's a rational call when you look at who was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time. And you'll find a few folks as implacable as Senator Eastland. So it's now gone to the Senate. What happened to it then? Let me put it this way. Who would like to be a lawyer for the next 5 minutes? All right. Everyone's saying, what the hell am I getting myself into if I say yes? I promise it's painless. Okay? Anjali, since you're in the back row, you're looking very intelligent today, and you're on the reading bench. I'd like for you to represent a senator who wants to kill this bill dead. You are implacable foes of rights. They turn your stomach. You can't understand how the federal government is arrogating this power to itself. Well, we've now had the House bill, which has now survived the full markup process and has now been approved by overwhelming margin, added to our calendar without any kind of hearings at all. What's your next step to try and stop this bill from seeing the light of day? It's been added to the calendar as a formality. But where in the calendar is it sitting now? Well, I'm not arguing about which calendar at this point. It's first in time, first in right. It's basically at the back of the line by definition, right? So we'll never see the light of day. So... Well, why are you filibustering? Remember, the bill's already dead. It's sitting in the back of the line and will never see Senate consideration because all the other bills in front of it. How do you bump something up on the calendar?
Oh.
First piece of advice to your client, the senator, is
there's not unanimous consent.
Right. Object. You don't have to agree to much of your bill. All it takes is one senator. I know he said something quite formal, but by the way, I will try very hard to be apolitical in this class. Sometimes I might say something construed that way, it's not meant that way, but if I do it, call me out on it. It's awfully fun to make fun of Ted Cruz sometimes, but only as a parliamentarian, not because of his politics. Okay, so with that in mind, you keep it from being put unanimously ahead of all the others. So what's the next thing they're going to have to do? They have to actually make a motion to bring it to the floor of the Senate, which is an actual voting decision by the Senate to basically change the queue. Well, guess what? What's your first filibuster over then? You said filibuster. What are you filibustering? Are you filibustering the act?
Yes.
Your co-counsel is shaking your head no.
What?
Yes.
The
person behind you saw clutching your chest like, oh, it wasn't me.
They had a 14-day debate just over whether to consider it, so I was the first to filibuster.
Exactly. A filibuster over whether or not you actually have a debate. A debate on a debate. Essentially then, that was step number one. That filibuster lasted until it included the Senate's consideration of other major legislation. And the other committee chairs all said they were going to halt consideration of any other bills until this one got decided, up or down. They took that mass coordinated objection to override that first filibuster. So, passed. You now have consideration on the floor of the Senate. Again, think about how the Senate's different than the House. There is no rule governing debate. There is no limit on non-germane amendments. The filibuster at that point is now happening again. And this is the one that most people thought was going to kill the civil rights movement. How do you blow past a filibuster on the substance of the Civil Rights Act at this point? Jordan?
Cloture.
Actually, no, that was very close. What does that mean?
It's just a vote that requires a supermajority, two-thirds, and it ends debate.
Right. And here, going back to the question previously, that's no longer the rule. It was two-thirds at the time. It's now 60. But nonetheless, let's keep going. So two-thirds at that time meant 66 votes, or 67 votes, I understand. Rolling on ahead. How do they build up that majority?
By making an amendment to it that would convince enough people to go along with it. Mm-hmm. And they softened, I think, just the jobs title of the bill a little bit. That's what I can.
No, and here, I can't resist. This is not something you need for the final exam. It's not something you'll need for anything other than just being a broadly informed person. But the name of the person who actually played that little role is actually worth keeping track of. Senator Dirksen. You go up to D.C., you'll notice that the office building there is the Dirksen office building. It's a hugely beautiful figure. It was also known as, I think the book said, the soldier of the blues. Very powerful Republican player. Essentially, he said, I will throw my weight behind the bill only if you've got it. This is a straight up by the rules plan that Republicans have done when Eisenhower had proposed a bill previously in 87. What happened at that point? You actually had pushback. The list of 40 amendments was trimmed to 10, and the 10 at the end of the day actually turned out to be focused mostly for small business protection. The overwhelming bulk of the most powerful portions of the bill survived. And you ended up with, essentially, an amendment that substituted the new text for the prior House bill and basically replaced it. But that replaced version was still substantively as strong as the House version with some minor modification. And then it was voted. Overrode the filibuster, and the vote of the bill itself was frankly anticlimactic. Done. But notice the weird pathway here. You basically halted consideration after this point, hijacked it, concluded the committee process, then actually had to have multiple interlocking, overlapping filibusters, and then you basically had a replacement of the entire act that the House approved by a different version. They basically struck everything out of the first sentence. All right. Are we done? You should know better than to shake your head no.
So basically, since they had that
Ryan.
So since they had that Mansfield substitution, they had to, the House and the Senate both have to have the identical bill.
Right.
So what happened is they went back to the House, and the House decided that they just wanted to cut their losses and just accept it as the Senate gave it because they figured it wouldn't go through otherwise if it went back.
Cogent, clear to the point. Thank you, Ryan. Exactly on point. Basically, there is no law at this point. The presentment requirement mandates that it actually be identical language for at least the president's desk. So the House at that point had to decide whether they're going to swallow this bill. They can either take that back and mark it up and change it back the way they like, and then resolve it through a conference committee, in which case Judge Smith and Senator Eastland have another shot at it. Or you just take it, call your losses, and move on. And that's what they did. They essentially threw out the child of all their work and accepted the Senate substitute for it, and that was it. The same day it was passed, it got sent over to the Senate. The Senate lodged it, and then went straight to President Johnson for a signature that evening. So this hopefully, rather than sort of walking through the Senate House rules, kind of gives you a bit more of an organic living sense of how this process works, and also how it can be broke, but in a very productive way. Any questions about this so far? Because next class, we're going to talk about how the rules have been amended and changed. I'd like to also bring before you a little bit of discussion, at least one of the bills that have been pending. And if you'll indulge me, just because it's something I'm kind of close to my heart, I'm going to talk about the Keystone XL legislation and what's happening with that. And then we'll finish up with the Duke Power exercise at the end of the chapter of our readings. So with that in mind, I want you to start thinking about the Duke Power example. We'll probably save our actual working through of it for the following class after that. All right, any last chance for questions, thoughts, suggestions, or ideas? Okay, before I dismiss you. Oh, yes. Remember, I said the reading for today was going to lead over to our next class.
Okay,
no, believe me, I will not give you 37-page assignments every class. especially since I had not appreciated how much text is on every page of this book. So the 1 through 37 includes tomorrow as well. So you basically, if you've done your reading, enjoy the day. And remember, if you want to go to the movie, I'll see you at 7:15 tonight at the Sundance Theater downtown. And don't forget Wednesday, EPS General Counsel, come over, I'll invite you to see you. Yes?
I think it's 7:45.
7:45?
7:45.
Thank you. Okay, Jay, I know it's Saturday. 7:45.